You know, I always like to start with a joke because I feel more comfortable and better if you're laughing at me, you know, but I'm kind of torn here. I can't decide between the self-effacing joke and the Baptist Catholic joke. So, you know, do you, Baptist Catholic? Huh? Both? Steve, I thought for sure you'd go with the self-effacing vote, you know, want to hear me put myself down. So, you know, actually, this one came from Nina, so you can, if you think it's funny, go tell her, and if you think it's not funny, definitely go tell her. So this young couple, you know, we're planning to get married, and just so happens one of them was a Baptist, one was a Catholic. And so they decide, well, we've got to find a, you know, a place to get married. So they go down to the Catholic church, you know, meet with the priest, and they're talking with him about having him marry them. And, you know, as they work through everything, they get to the end of it. So they say, oh, by the way, how many people will the parish hold? How many, you know, so we know how many people we can invite. They say, well, you know, it'll hold 150 Catholics or it'll hold 200 Baptists. And they kind of looked at each other and, you know, and couldn't quite figure that out. And they turned back to him and said, I don't understand. Why does it hold more Baptists? And he said, well, Baptists are much more narrow than Catholics. And I'm pretty sure that Nina told me that because she comes from a Catholic background and I come from a Baptist background. So she wanted to make sure I was aware of that Baptists are much more narrow than Catholics. Okie dokie. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, well, I figure if we start with a bad joke that it can only go uphill from there. So, yeah, maybe. Nice, Tony. Thank you. I like that. See, it's self-effacing humor. Yes, there we go. You know, I want to do something really different, you know, or start in a very different way this morning. I'm actually going to read to you almost an entire chapter from the Bible, and it's Matthew 5. It's the first chapter of the Sermon on the Mount. But I want us to do this in a real different way. When we get to that point, I'm going to ask you to close your eyes and actually place yourself on that hill with Jesus. Matthew 5 is the first of three chapters of the Sermon on the Mount. It is it's Jesus talking to his climbing companions. As a matter of fact, the way it starts out is, when Jesus saw his ministry drawing huge crowds, he climbed a hillside. Those who were apprenticed to him, the committed, climbed with him. Arriving at a quiet place, he sat down and taught his climbing companions. So I want you to realize, you know, we are the apprentices. We are those that are committed. You know, we're here this morning because we want to see this path a little more clearly. We want to get a little better sense of God, sense of Jesus and his place in our life. So we're trying to understand this journey and trying to find this journey. So Jesus is, in this chapter, indeed speaking directly to us. And, you know, as you listen to it, I want you to try and go beyond the words. I want you to hear what's actually coming from him. You know, a couple of things that really struck me. First of all, you know, it says that the Jews were always really blown away by the authority in his voice, the authority in his message. And that's going to come through loud and clear. You're going to hear, as you hear his words, you're going to hear the authority that he speaks with. The other thing that that I think comes clear is a real sense that he wants us to get this. He really wants us to get this. He keeps coming back at this from multiple different angles, from one way to another way to another way, trying to help us find this, trying to help us see this thing called kingdom, this new walk, this new life. And, you know, I can't help but connect with that, that part of him that's so interested in me and so concerned about me and wanting me to find, wanting us to find this new journey. So at this point, what I want you to do is close your eyes, and if you're uncomfortable closing your eyes in here, fix your eyes on the cross or on the overhead monitor, but place yourself on that hillside just right now. Close your eyes. You're on the hillside. You've just followed Jesus up the side of the hill, and you're taking a seat in the grass, and you're looking up at him. He's up ahead of you, sitting on a rock, and he's about to start talking and start teaching. You're blessed when you're at the end of your rope. With less of you, there is more of God and His rule. You're blessed when you feel you've lost what is most dear to you. Only then can you be embraced by the one most dear to you. You're blessed when you're content with just who you are, no more, no less. That's the moment you find yourselves proud owners of everything that can't be bought. You're blessed when you've worked up a good appetite for God. He's food and drink and the best meal you'll ever eat. You're blessed when you care. At the moment of being careful, you'll find yourselves cared for. You're blessed when you get your inside world, your mind and heart, put right. Only then can you see God in the outside world. You're blessed when you can show people how to cooperate instead of compete or fight. That's when you discover who you really are and your place in God's family. You're blessed when your commitment to God provokes persecution. The persecution drives you even deeper into God's kingdom. Not only that, count yourselves blessed every time people put you down or throw you out or speak lies about you to discredit me. What it means is the truth is too close for comfort, and they are uncomfortable. You can be glad when that happens. Give a cheer, even. For though they don't like it, I do, and all heaven applauds. And know that you are in good company. My prophets and witnesses have always gotten into this kind of trouble. Let me tell you why you are here. You are here to be the salt seasoning that brings out the God flavors of this earth. If you lose your saltiness, how will people taste godliness? You've lost your usefulness and will end up in the garbage. Here's another way to put it. You're here to be light, bringing out the God colors in the world. God is not a secret to be kept. We are going public with this, as public as a city on a hill. If I make you light bearers, you don't think I'm going to put you under a bucket, do you? I'm putting you on a light stand. And now that I've put you there on a hilltop, on a light stand, shine. Keep open house. Be generous with your lives. By opening up to others, you'll prompt people to open up with God, this generous Father in heaven. Don't suppose for a minute that I've come to demolish the Scriptures, either God's law or the prophets. I'm not here to demolish, but to complete. I'm going to put it all together, in a vast panorama. God's law is more real and lasting than the stars in the sky and the ground at your feet. Long after the stars burn out and the earth wears out, God's law will be alive and working. Trivialized even the smallest item in God's law, and you'll only have trivialized yourself. But take it seriously, show the way for others, and you will find honor in the kingdom. Unless you do far better than the Pharisees in the matters of right living, you won't know the first thing about entering kingdom. You're familiar with the command to the ancients, do not murder. I'm telling you that anyone who is so much as angry with a brother or sister is guilty of murder. Carelessly call a brother idiot, and you just might find yourself hauled into court. Thoughtlessly yell stupid at a sister, and you're on the brink of hellfire. The simple moral fact is that words kill. This is how I want you to conduct yourself in these matters. If you enter your place of worship and, about to make an offering, you suddenly remember a grudge that a friend has against you, abandon your offering. Leave immediately. Go to this friend and make things right. Then and only then, come back and work things out with God. Or say you're on the street and an old enemy accosts you. Don't lose a minute. Make the first move. Make things right with him. After all,
If you leave the first move to him, knowing his track record, you're likely to end up in court, maybe even jail. If that happens, you won't get out without a stiff fine. You know the next commandment pretty well, too. Don't go to bed with another's spouse. But don't think you've preserved your virtue simply by staying out of bed. Your heart can be corrupted by lust even quicker than your body. Those leering looks you think nobody notices, they also corrupt. And don't say anything you don't mean. This counsel is embedded deep in our traditions. You only make things worse when you lay down a smokescreen of pious talk, saying, I'll pray for you and never doing it, or saying, God be with you and not meaning it. You don't make your words true by embellishing them with religious lace. In making your speech sound more religious, it becomes less true. You say yes and no. When you manipulate words to get your own way, you go wrong. Here's another old saying that deserves a second look. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Is that going to get us anywhere? Here's what I propose. Don't hit back at all. If someone strikes you, stand there and take it. If someone drags you into court and sues for the shirt off your back, gift wrap your best coat and make a present of it. And if someone takes unfair advantage of you, use the occasion to practice the servant life. No more tit-for-tat stuff. Live generously. You're familiar with the old written law. Love your friend and its unwritten companion. Hate your enemy. I'm challenging that. I'm telling you to love your enemies. Let them bring out the best in you, not the worst. When someone gives you a hard time, respond with the energies of prayer, for then you're working out of your true selves, your God-created selves. This is what God does. He gives his best, the sun to warm and the rain to nourish, to everyone, regardless, the good and the bad, the nice and the nasty. If all you do is love the lovable, do you expect a bonus? Anybody can do that. If you simply say hello to those who greet you, do you expect a medal? Any run-of-the-mill sinner does that. In a word, what I'm saying is, grow up. You are kingdom subjects. Now live like it. Live out your God-created identity. Live generously and graciously toward others, the way God lives toward you. Okay. You may open your eyes. I hope you heard something in there that maybe spoke to you anew, you know, touched you in a new place. I read through this chapter several times as I was thinking about this and working on this, and it really took me to a different place, and that's why I titled this A Shift in Perspective. But as I fed my way through this, as I worked my way through this, it came to give me a different sense of what this journey is that I'm on. And I want to take you on that just real quickly. You know, the first thing is this, the sense of progression that I get as I look at this chapter and I look at Jesus' words here, the sense of progression is much like the progression that we see in recovery. A lot of us in here are, you know, in recovery from drugs and alcohol. And, you know, there's a good reason the 12 steps were taken from the book of James and the Sermon on the Mount. And so there's a very valid reason that I see the same progression. But, you know, when we think about recovery, when we see what the recovery journey looks like, early recovery is very selfish. Early recovery is very much about me finding my way to get through the next 24 hours without drinking or using. It's very much about me finding just exactly what I need in order to find this new life, to start a new life. Early recovery is selfish. You know, I would tell you that it's 90% about me finding what I need, you know, and maybe 10% left over to extend some encouragement to someone else. And that's the way it has to be. You know, when I get here, I've got to find this path. I've got to find my way through this. I've got to find a new life a new opportunity for life. And that's what early recovery is. So I go to meetings and I listen for the encouragement I need. I listen for the solution that I need to find my way through this. But as I continue to move in to recovery, as I continue to move down that path, you know, it begins to shift. And whereas first it's 90% about me and maybe 10% left over to extend a hand to a newcomer, the ratio begins to shift and it becomes more like 80% is focused on me, 20% is focused on someone else, encouraging someone else, lifting them up. And that that ratio continues to shift as I move through, and it becomes 70-30 and 60-40 and then 50-50. And as I continue to chase this thing called recovery, as I continue to move into it and work the steps and find a new path, that ratio, that attention continues to change, and it continues to move in the opposite direction until in the end, you know, recovery for me today is maybe 10% about me finding, you know, the encouragement that I need to stay sober, and it's 90% about touching someone else, about encouraging someone else, about giving it away. And what I find and what I have found is that the true nature of recovery, the promises of recovery, the happy, joyous, and free of recovery is not in me going to the meetings to find the solution that I need or the encouragement I need. The real journey of recovery and the real happiness and the promises are found in giving it away. It's found in that 90% that turns me outside of myself and causes me to look at someone else, to touch someone else, to encourage someone else, to give to someone else. That's where I find that the promises. That's where I find the happiness. And this is the path of recovery, but it's also the path of spirituality. You know, and it's funny, but as I looked at these first Beatitudes, the first ones are very much about what I can expect from God. You know, if you look at them, you're blessed when you're at the end of the rope, your rope. You're blessed when you feel like you've lost what's most dear to you. You're blessed when you're content with just who you are. You're blessed when you've worked up a good appetite for God. All of these first Beatitudes are very much about what I can expect from God, how I connect with Him, how I find His power and presence in my life. You know, what the journey looks like, me finding less of myself and more of Him. You know, that's what early spirituality looks like, just as early recovery is about me finding the recovery I need. But then, at number 8, at verse 8, you're blessed when you get your inside world, your mind and heart put right. Then you can see God in the outside world. At verse 8, it begins to change. It begins to turn. All of a sudden, you know, I have found my path. I've found my connection with God. I've found the strength and the beauty of that relationship. And all of a sudden, my view can turn outward. You know, what I have to offer can turn outward. So just like in recovery, you know, it changes from me chasing this just for what I need to me chasing it for someone else. It's what spirituality looks like. You know, I want to direct your attention. In the bulletin down at the bottom, there's a graphic there. If you take a look, it's three linked hearts. Now, this is a graphic or a visual that really helps me kind of understand my place in all of this, my place or what I need to focus on, what I need to chase in this relationship. You see, to me, these hearts represent my relationship with God, my relationship with myself, and my relationship with others, okay? And for me, I really can't find a way to do one without the others, okay, is the best way that I can put it. If I want to chase and find a closer connection with God and a closer relationship, a closer walk with Him, a more meaningful connection with Him, I can't do it totally separate from my relationship with others and my relationship with myself. And here's what I mean by that, because that sounds kind of unusual. But if I'm trying to connect with God, if I'm trying to find power in that relationship, and at the same time I'm ignoring some decisions that I'm making, some things that I'm doing that I know are really not right, that I know are really, you know, not the best thing that I could be doing. It's hard for me to really come to God with a clean conscience and to come to Him openly and to feel the power in that connection with Him. I want to read something here from Joyce Meyer. She addresses this and does it in a really incredible way. She says, the ladies are loving this. When Jesus talked about the greatest commandment of all, He quoted Deuteronomy 6:5 and said we're to love God with all our heart. But He also added a second greatest commandment. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. There's something important here that I think people often miss. You cannot give away something you don't have in you. How can someone love another person if they don't love themselves? We all need to accept ourselves, embrace our personalities, and even our imperfections, knowing that although we are not where we need to be, we are making progress. Jesus died for us because we have weaknesses and imperfections, and we don't have to reject ourselves because of them. God wants us to love ourselves and enjoy how He's made us. Yeah, that's incredible. And you know what I love about this? It addresses, to me, what's both sides of the equation. I accept the fact that I'm broken. I accept the fact that, you know, I cannot be good enough. I cannot act good enough. I cannot ever be worthy. I cannot earn my way into a perfect relationship with God. And I accept that. But at the same time, that doesn't mean that I accept and just give up and don't try anymore. I still chase perfection. I chase God. I chase that love relationship. I want to get closer to Him. I want to be better. And so, you know, it's like I'm addressing this from both ends. I accept the fact that I'm broken, and yet I try to be the very best that I can. And for me, that's what the path looks like through it. It is this combination of humility and striving that allow me to connect with others in a very real and meaningful way. Richard Rohr wrote something in one of his daily meditations that I really like. He says, the enormous breakthrough happens when you honor and accept the divine image within yourself, and henceforth cannot help but see it in everybody else too. And you know it is just as undeserved and unmerited in them as it is in you. That is almost the only way you can stop judging. And that is how you start loving unconditionally and without asking whether someone is worthy or not. The breakthrough often occurs like a momentary thunderbolt, although the living realization deepens and takes on conviction only over many years. So the first piece of this equation, the first heart, you know, is about me accepting myself, loving myself, accepting my brokenness, while at the same time striving to be all that I can be, you know, connecting the dot with God, chasing that relationship, trying to improve it, you know, but connecting with myself in the process and bettering myself in the process. You know, for me, others are a big part of this too. If I'm still in that position of harboring resentments, harboring anger, holding on to that, you know, I still can't come to God with a real clean conscience, with a real clean connection. I've got to be willing to let go of those things. Holding on to a resentment is very much like telling God, I don't really trust you to handle this the way it needs to be handled. I need to deal with this one myself to make sure that they get taught the lesson they need to be taught. That's pretty much what that boils down to when I'm holding on to the resentments and the anger. And I want to point you at a couple of the verses right here in chapter 5. You may not have quite recognized them as I read them through in the Message translation, but verse 23 and 24, in the NIV it says, if you're offering your gift before the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you, first go and be reconciled with your brother, then come and offer your gift. Now, let's bring that into today's English. You know, we've heard this verse many times, and we, you know, we understand it, we accept it, you know, we kind of get it. But the altar was the way the Jewish people thanked God,
showed their gratitude, showed their gratefulness. You know, if they had a good crop, they brought their first fruits and offered them on the altar. You know, if they did something wrong, they went to the altar to offer a sacrifice for atonement or forgiveness of sin. So that's what the altar was. It was the communication between the Jews and God, and it was their way of thanking Him and of asking forgiveness. Today we do that through prayer. You know, that's my journey. That's the way I come to God. I come to God. I thank Him for the blessings in my life, the great things that He's done for me, and I ask for forgiveness for the things that, you know, that I've done wrong, places I've separated myself from Him, chosen my way over His way. And that's what prayer is for. But if I bring that verse into today's parlance, today's English, it is be something like this. If you're about to get on your knees and say your evening prayers and remember that your friend, acquaintance, brother or sister, relative has something against you, first go and be reconciled with them. Then come and say your prayers. You know, he's trying to point us at something really critical here and really big, and it's something that I don't want to look at because it's uncomfortable. But Jesus is really telling us that these relationships have an impact on my ability to connect with God. You know, Dave has a great way of putting it. He says, our relationship with God can never be better than our worst relationship with someone else. And it's the same kind of thought. It's the same kind of understanding. There is a disconnect in that relationship. There is an inability for me to proceed beyond a certain point in my relationship with God if I'm harboring, allowing, or not addressing breakdowns in my relationships with others. It's just part of it. It's just a piece of the puzzle. So for me, I look at these three connected hearts. I look at them like concentric rings that are all joined together. And I float them higher or lower as a unit. You know, they move up or down together in connection with one another. I can't do it independently. And that's just something that works for me. That's something that, you know, that gives me a visual of what I'm trying to accomplish. But I look at the three, and I see where they lead me, and I make sure that I give them each the attention they deserve. Focusing on the relationship with God, that's primary and of most importance, because it's only through that true connection with Him, it's only through the power of that love relationship that I have the desire to change, that I have the desire to move in a new direction for me, that I have the willingness to reconnect with another human being in my life or resolve a problem in my life. So that's the primary point. That's the primary part of the connection. You know, but all three are connected and all three have an impact on each other. You know, the last piece of this and addressing the title of the message today, A Shift in Perspective. I've always viewed my role in the Christian life, the Christian journey, the pathway to God. You know, I've always viewed this as being the most important thing is, you know, me finding that connection point, me finding that walk with God. You know, I pray, I read the Bible, I come to church, I try to act better, to be better. You know, the whole thing is about this relationship, seeking His face, getting to know Him better, empowering that relationship. And that's always made the most sense to me. And yes, I treat others the way I want to be treated, and I'm good, and I love others, and so on and so forth. But the primary part of the relationship, you know, has always felt, or the point of the journey, the point of what I'm here for, has always been about this connection, chasing Him, seeking Him, becoming more like Him, getting to know Him better. But as I read this chapter over and over, and as I really looked at it and considered it, and as I thought about these verses, you know, I think Jesus is pointing us in the same direction that we saw with the recovery journey. You know, He's telling us that the point of the exercise is not about this relationship. The point of the exercise is about this relationship.
He's saying, I called you here to be the salt of the earth. You know, I called you here to be the lamp on the lampstand. I called you here to be an attractor to me and my unconditional love. We are God's hands and feet and mouth. We are His preferred method of connecting with another human being. You know, God can certainly move in someone's heart, draw them to Him, work a miracle within Him, and He does it all the time. But I truly believe that we are His preferred method of touching another human being. He wants to work through us. He wants to use us. He wants people to see Him in us. And that's the point of the exercise. That's why I'm here. I chase this relationship so I have something to offer this relationship. Just like in recovery, I chase my own recovery so I have something to offer the other alcoholic. I chase God so that I can indeed be the salt of the earth, the lamp on the lampstand, the city on the hill, the attractor. That's what I'm called to be. In closing, I want to share something that happened six, seven months ago, I moved into rented a house with a couple of buddies. James is one of my roommates, and then another buddy, Mike. And about a month after we moved in, we decided to have a party. So we had a housewarming party and had a ton of people, you know, 50, 60 people came over and barbecued and big, you know, filled up the backyard with people. And it was an incredible time. And we invited some of the neighbors over, and it's just absolutely an incredible afternoon, fun time. Lots of good food, and there was food left over, so nobody went hungry. So it was just, you know, perfect party. And about 3 weeks after the party, this party that I thought, and I was, you know, three of the four neighbors that we invited came over, and you know, and I thought that was fun. You know, of course, a couple of them showed up with drinks in their hand, and so I think there was a little bit of discomfort when they realized they were the only ones with drinks in their hand at our little sober party. But it was okay. It was still a mixed audience. There were a lot of normies there, you know, as well as people in recovery. And we even received like three bottles of wine from people as housewarming gifts. So that clues you in that people were not exactly aware that this was a house full of people in recovery. You know, or maybe they were aware of that and just wanted to see what would happen if they gave us a bottle of wine. I don't know. But anyway, about 3 weeks after this party, we get a call from the landlord's representative that two of our neighbors have filed a complaint. And, you know, and it was just a bunch of piddly stuff. It was kind of like working on a car in the driveway and, you know, the noise that that Mike's hot rod makes on Saturday morning when he starts it up to go to his car club and, you know, and just kind of stuff that you just scratch your head and wonder what, you know, what the big deal is or what the problem is. And so my third roommate, Mike, he's kind of the direct type. So he went over to the neighbor that, you know, we knew it had to be as the ringleader of it. And, you know, and he said, you know, he told the guy, he said, you know what, if you got a problem with us, come talk to us. You know, just tell us what the problem is. We're happy to address it. Well, as they continued the conversation, the problem turned out to be the fact that we were in recovery. The problem, the deep down problem with the neighbors was that they didn't like having people in the neighborhood that were in recovery. To them, that meant that there might be a lot of drugs or alcohol invited to the neighborhood. You know, it meant that we might fill up the house with 10 or 20 of us, you know, and spill over into the neighborhood and cause a problem or an eyesore or whatever. And, you know, and Mike really tried hard. He tried to explain it to him. He said, look, we've got time. He said, I got 12 years. Frank's got, you know, so many years. James has so much time. You know, we've been doing this for a while. We're, you know, it's not like things are going to go south necessarily. Unless you push us to it, you know, but things are probably going to be pretty good. And he said, and by the way, you know, Frank's even a pastor at church and so on and so forth. But this guy was having none of it. He even said, you know what? He said, I'm really strongly considering getting a lawyer and harassing your landlord until he kicks you out. Yeah. You know, and I got to tell you, as a white male, that's probably the first time in my life that I really felt persecuted, looked down on, marginalized, you know, for something that I can't help, for something that's part of me. I had never really experienced that before, and that was an eye-opening experience. It took me most of a day to work through this. I started with anger and let's go get a bunch of salt and make an AA symbol in his front yard in the grass, kill the grass in an AA symbol, you know. I had all kinds of brilliant thoughts about what we could do with that. Yeah, you know, and then it was just sadness, just a depression, you know, directed at me and then directed at him. That anyone could be that hurtful and hateful and unfair, you know, in the judgment of us. And God, don't they know that we're nice people? And we invited them to the party and fed them. I mean, holy cow. So, you know, it wasn't until about, 6 or 8 o'clock that night after a full day of really, really struggling with this, I finally came to the point where I said, you know what? I may be the only face of recovery that this guy ever sees, and I may be the only Christian or the only pastor that this guy ever sees. So I'm just going to continue to smile. I'm going to continue to wave. I'm going to continue to look for the opportunity to talk to them, to let them know there's no hard feelings. You know, I'm just going to try and remind myself and be something different, the face of something different than what they normally would experience or expect to experience in this situation. And that's what I've done for the last 6 months. You know, I try to smile, I try to wave. Yeah, I can't catch his attention very often. He won't acknowledge me. But when he does, I smile and wave and look for the opportunity to talk to him. And I don't tell you this so that maybe you'll think I'm a saint or anything else. Most of you know me well enough. I couldn't sell you on that anyway. You know, but it was probably the first time or one of the few times that I feel like I've really had an opportunity to do this right. It's one of the times I feel like I've really had the opportunity to respond in this way that we're being encouraged to respond. You see, what Jesus is saying all through this is the true test is not how I treat my friends. The true test is how I treat those that look down on me. The true test is how I treat those that belittle me or disparage me, or they're rude to me, or they're mean to me. That's a real test. That's when I have the opportunity to show that there's something different here. Because with a friend, I'm always going to smile. I'm always going to treat them nice. I'm always going to be, it's easy to be that person. That's not different. The whole world acts that way. You know, the challenge comes, the test comes when it's not that easy. When it's more difficult, when they're treating me unfairly or poorly. That's where I get the opportunity to really show what my God means to me. So I hope you have the opportunity this week to chase some of that. I hope you have the opportunity this week to realize that that our big opportunity is in behaving differently in a way that draws attention to him. To be the friend when a friend is not deserved or earned. To be loving and accepting and non-judging, even when it would be much easier to do that. That's our opportunity to channel God's unconditional love from him to us and outward to the rest of the world. Let's pray. Father, thank you that you love us in spite of ourselves. Thank you that you love us just as we are, broken, challenged, and just trying to find a way through this and find a way to do this. Help us on this journey. Help us every day to rise to the occasion, to realize that we are reflecting what we believe about you, whether we are wanting to or not, that every connection we have with another person, every opportunity we have to be a part of someone's life, you know, shows what we believe about you, shows what we think of you, and gives them a taste of who you are to us. So help us do it well. We need your help. We thank you, we love you, and we pray it in Jesus' name. Amen. Amen.